First of all, what a delight to be here, and thank you all very much for coming and for staying after the interval. And huge thanks to Stephen and your colleagues for supporting this and making it possible. I think it's such a wonderful venue to be doing this in. John, I thought your talk was absolutely illuminating. I'm thrilled to have heard it, but it's a bit of a hard act to follow Judith Wright and Michael Donaghy. But I wanted to start by remarking that I found it curious that one or two of the reviews of my book have talked about the arcane and esoteric nature of the subject matter. And although I don't want to seem at all ungrateful, on the contrary, the poems commemorate some of the most important scientific discoveries and investigations upon which our current state of knowledge and practice depends. And so it's put me in mind, many of you will be far too young to remember, the two cultures debate that was started by C.P. Snow in 1959, something like that. Which I don't propose to rehearse now, except for the remark that he made, how curious it was that you could know a lot of poetry and know science and call yourself cultured, but that if you knew a lot of science and no poetry, you were irredeemably uncultured. Well, I was one of those people who had to choose at the age of 16 between humanities and science, and I chose humanities, not to my regret, but I do regret, and I think I've been trying to make up for the fact that my science education stopped dead then. All sorts of things kind of follow from that in a way, including the fact that that sort of choice, as I realise to my great chagrin later, is class-based. That the really clever boys at public school were all shunted in the direction of Latin and Greek, and it was only the sort of the ones for whom there was no hope who were pushed towards the science labs. I find that quite extraordinary. Anyway, my project, which found its expression in this book, didn't start from any grand theories or big ideas. It started with exactly the kind of objects and instruments and contrivances that you see all around you. And I think the wonderful craftspersonship that went into these things, many of them, their functions remain completely obscure to me, but they are beautiful in themselves as artifacts. And that's where all this began. And particularly with a globe, a miniature globe that used to belong to my grandfather, and I have no idea how he came to acquire it. They were very popular in the 18th and 19th centuries for teaching children about the world. And of course, one of the interesting things is that they represent the continents as they were then understood to be. And my grandfather's had an extra special feature, which was that it was encased in two hemispheres that came apart. And on the inside of those hemispheres were illustrated the constellations. So you've got this little miniature cosmos that you could hold in your hand. Globe. Oh, and the other thing I need to tell you is that if you happen to have one, you can sell it for about £6,000. Globe. I was always an only child. Reading the children's encyclopedia, I knew the Hittites and Hottentots were just an atlas away, that the eastern steppes were wonder tales of mare's milk, mazurkas, that the robber girl kept a knife in her furs, that if I went far enough, I could return to where I am now. My grandmother ironing silver sweet papers flat with her thumbnail. Willow warbler, another bird my grandfather taught me. Oh, solemn temples and cigarette cards. The one thing of his was a small pocket globe with a hooked catch, keeping the two halves of the cosmos closed, the dark reef of New Holland lying under the long coasts of Australia. Or I could have held it in one hand, made the wrinkled earth apple turn in the burnished bowl of its heavens. I was reading the Reader's Digest, where it pays to increase your word power. But what the world was worth is a riddle I couldn't imagine. There's something about scientific discovery that is likely to upset the status quo. And I think that's partly why some poets are drawn to it. And the first mechanized clock was brought to China in the Ming Dynasty, that is to say the 16th century in the Christian era, by Jesuit missionaries on their travels over to the Far East from Venice. The emperor's mother has delusions. I sit, still and invisible, behind the quilted silk in the innermost room of the great within, where only your ministers seeking audience may tread in cotton slippers on the lacquered floor that reflects their petticoats. But I know, they know, I see and hear many things. Do you not hear it, my son? The soft whirring of the machine that came bandaged in linen, carried over a winter and summer of deserts and through all the houses of the zodiac from the city they say floats on a bowl of sea, whose palaces are bright as rice lanterns, whose women are monster-footed. Its intricate little tines and springs have more tricks than the new concubine I've been feeding on musk. But its 50 clicking wheels presume to bear the weight of our imperial days that were once dense with computations of jasmine. It has gone hunting in the heavens, this thing they call a clock, and caged the sun. My son, the great walls of our eternity are breached. Do you not see? The scents of time passing are no longer sweet, and the end of wisdom has begun. The opening poem of the collection was a response to some papier-mâché models that I saw or encountered. I like that word that you used for us, John. In the sister organisation to this one, the Whipple Museum in Cambridge. And these papier-mâché models were used in the 19th century to teach medical students about the workings of the human body. And they came apart and could be reassembled. And they were painted in very garish colours. You can take the eye out so that you can look at how the optic nerve works, and of course a great deal more tasteful than cadavers, which is what medical students had to use up until that point. And it's called organ. Apparently I am made of parts, a locked box of troubles, a walled town always on the brink of plague, rebellion, a medieval sunless place of chopped rags and powdered cork held together with flour paste, then gesso painted to look real. The attention to detail is breathtaking. This set of female pieces is especially useful for students. It diagnoses a human womb in the gothic of pregnancy, disclosing the little male tucked inside like the very last doll or a silent growth. The wire nerves, red ribbon veins, relentless panorama of follies. See, these lobotomies and hysterectomies are mendable. Their vivid jigsaws, like slipper orchids, leave nothing to the imagination. But behind my skirts, I am unlit rooms, a visionary anatomy shaken by small fevers. How I live is dark science, fretful fugue, a mirror under a shawl. And the title poem, Cloud Camera, I suppose is emblematic of the way that I was trying to tackle the subjects that gave themselves to me, which is to try and invest them with a dream life, try and put my own imagination, my own strange interior life inside these instruments. And the cover of the book, designed by a wonderful artist, Sally Castle, has an image of what a cloud camera might show you, which is an image of the whole sky with all the beautiful cloud movements. It might be like looking at the sky in a large bowl of water, something like that. And they were, invented and very popular early 19th century, something like that. Stephen, you might be able to put me right on this. But anyway. Cloud camera. I found an Edwardian pair of earrings. You could call it theft or rescue, call it teardrops, or an omnicolor portrait of a lady, an image of the whole sky, inevitably appearing distorted from whatever distance it is looked at. I do not know why such sophisticated equipment was necessary, though clouds can be heartbreakingly beautiful with their marquesites and hidden childhoods, their insides of light. Nor why, when I woke, I felt contented in that after-rain way I remember from our pinhole years. The edges are silvered, foxed, enchanting despite or because of the angle of the rays, which I have no option but to call phi and theta. Not all these handheld poses will be successful. 180 degrees on a plate asks for open-heartedness as well as skill. As I said, we were in a house behaving like a short story. The clouds were perfect and round. And this poem is to commemorate Caroline Herschel, one of the most extraordinary astronomers, but I think tending to be overshadowed by her brother quite a lot of the time. And he built her a telescope for looking for comets, and she found many, many comets with her comet sweeper. In another dream, it is I who am flying. Wherever you look, there are people in pain, suffering unseen intrusions, eavesdroppers, radiations. All those telescopes leaking light, too faint and far away for warmth. She sits too long, grinding glass for mirrors, while I levitate around the room at head height, reading over her rheumatic-y shoulder some notes she made in the small hours. Laborious almanacs of unworthy stars. I was surprised, expecting a more ostentatious repertoire. Her astral body, often visible in a domestic role, is really a dwarf elliptical galaxy made of dust and helium. Nonetheless, what with the empty distances there and back, their tempi of slow foxtrot and delirium, it was the eight comets more than the unwritten autobiography that made her name. Those scene stealers of flare-up, tail plumes, flight path too near Earth. And from the telescope to the microscope. And this poem tries to recreate this. I think it must have been a very strange kind of vertigo that people must have experienced when they first looked down a microscope. And I realized that a lot of these poems are about looking, about what we think we can see. And one of the things that people probably were most likely to look at were lice and fleas, because they were so readily to hand. And there is, of course, William Blake's extraordinary phantasmagorical miniature called Ghost of a Flea. And he makes his appearance in this poem as well. A hair's breadth. Things always look larger than you remember. The way a dream rearranges the past, giving you a makeshift husband, a house with jaunty rooms, catching the children at their most unearthly. This is one way to summon the spirits. Or, put your face here till the slip of glass opens its eye on a caber of mouse fur. The seance proceeds. Staring back at you is the illusion of intimacy, haloed in gold leaf, hulking and skulking, lit by stars. A horsefly's sight organs are Betelgers prancing in a blackened field. The rap on the table is the vast queue of animalcules and homunculi pleading with you to call them by name. Oh, you have disturbed their sleep. Now do you believe? Staying with the microscopic and what we might imagine we can, if we can't see it, we imagine it. I suppose that's part of the issue here. And I have a thing about drinking water, and my husband castigates me for always drinking bottled water because it's environmentally unsound in every possible way you can imagine. And this poem, in a way, is sort of my weak excuse for not drinking tap water. Germ theory. We are all sapiens, all cherishable, even those of us who drink only bottled water, for fear of what's hatching in the cut glass carafe. Microbiology is a slow science. Plenty of time for the pigtailed bacilli of anxiety to divide and pullulate like a saucer of leprechauns, Escherichia coli, variola, Vibrio cholerae, a tsunami of golden staphylococci pouring from the standpipe of imagination that in hours will flood the street with corpses. At the Hotel Dieu, a man in fancy dress has suddenly collapsed, and underneath his mask, his face is violet blue. A horrified dowager drops her teacup. She eyes the scientist soup of magnified pathogens gurgling in her taps, the curdle of volatile iodine circulating through her veins. We wash our hands and wash our hands, refuse ice in our summer daiquiris. On a window ledge, little flasks of pandemonium ferment and seethe. One of the things that I have learnt to admire about scientists through the ages is their willingness to experiment on themselves, sometimes with absolutely dire effects. This poem alludes to the fact that Humphrey Davy, that great inventor and discoverer and investigator, did a huge amount of experiments with apparently no great ill effects on himself with nitrous oxide or laughing gas. And the other thing about it is that he had these parties and he'd invite people to come and do the same thing and then write about their experiences while they were under the influence. I think it makes our dope parties of the 1960s look very tame. And so the epigraph to this poem is from a Mr. Coates of Bristol, about whom I don't think very much more is known, but he said, "I experienced a degree of hilarity altogether new to me." And there are a couple of places in the poem where I quote from other people's journals as well, and I'll try to make it clear when it's them and when it's me. What Humphrey Davy didn't do was to explore the potential of nitrous oxide for anaesthesia. And when I was giving birth to my second child, I can tell you I was very, very glad that somebody had. So, laughing gas. There were only minutes to go. I was on my knees in a kind of ravishment, inhaling the amiable gas as if her life depended on it. The room was full of watchers, yet I was taking a solitary moonlit walk through shoeless corridors until the small hours grew huge with euphoric light. I suddenly lost sight of all the objects round me, they being apparently obscured by clouds in which were many luminous points. I was rolling in the aisles, I was splitting my sides, I was hysterical, fit to burst. Meticulous notes were taken, but as if seen through a shine of tears, and although next day the entire experience appeared dreamlike, I felt like the sound of a harp. I seemed a sublime being, newly created. I was ready to die laughing. I've been very impressed by the exploit of Felix Baumgartner, who recently attempted and succeeded in breaking the record for the longest highest human freefall from miles up there. The record was previously held by Captain Joseph Kittinger, and this poem is about that. But it's also about the human obsession with flying. And in the early 19th century, the way that people took to the air was in air balloons. But of course, they didn't send people up there first. They sent up a basket with a sheep, a duck, and a cockerel, which is the title of my poem, in it first. But I was intrigued to find out that from Richard Holmes's wonderful book called The Age of Wonder, if you don't know it, I thoroughly recommend it. It deals with some of the same things about the connections between the scientists and the poets, but in the 18th and early 19th centuries. Anyway, Richard Holmes tells us that at that time there were rumours of a French airborne army invading Britain, and the troops, it was believed, would fly suspended beneath hundreds of huge paper bags. Midnight strikes, and a flock of paper bags stuffed full of air is lofted by the heat of single tea lights. As they take to the skies, this is the only sight worth watching. The fluttering aeronautical flames like guardian angels, secret agents in the hawkish dark. A cage of creatures soars tipsily above the roofs of Versailles. We all know a man will have to be next, then the whole kit and boodle. Captain Joe Joseph W. Kittinger, Jr., says his prayers, steps off, and begins the 20-mile, 4-minute freefall to Earth. He can see the extraordinary glow of its manifold atmospheres as the heaven beneath him turns black, and his ungloved right hand swells up like a balloon. The leaves of the in-flight magazine squeak a little as I flick them over, deciding between wristwatches. Ice crystals have formed on the portholes. Looking is always an act of desire, and what he sees is the curve of a wind-blown planet streaking towards him, its gold-rimmed clouds where the tragic weathers reside. Yesterday, the no-fly zone over Disney World was extended sine fine. Vogue is warning, ditch those shimmery highlighters. The air is a fragile coincidence. Feel it on the high planes of your face. And finally, because of this sense of transgression, of going to places where mere mortals, even poets, might fear to go, this is a poem about a transgressor extraordinaire. The Dr. James Barry rose to the rank of Inspector General in charge of military hospitals in the UK and abroad. When he died, an autopsy had to be performed, and it was discovered that he was a woman. But of course, in those days, you couldn't be a qualified doctor and do all of those things if you were a woman. And so this poem imagines Dr. James Barry as a male impersonator in the heyday of the music hall. And it's called On Travesty. Next on, a breeches role. The ginger mustachioed Inspector General, 3-inch lifts in her shoes and a spit and polish swagger for the jostling crowd. She'll play you Piccadilly Johnny all his little vanities. She'll give you the brittle songs the soldiers used to sing. She'll remind you of the times you longed to be a boy. More than the pretense of shoulders or the verismo voice, more than the daily breast bindings or the delicate question of testosterone, the telltale jawbone, the effeminate gait, is the control of infectious feelings, the stiff upper lip and rock-steady hand in the death-dealing epidemic of war, Waterloo, Crimea, Jamaica, Corfu, the fire-eaters and smoke machines, the hullabaloo. Now watch her, dolled up in battle dress, grand cavalry sword on her hip. Ladies, the Dr. James Barry, put your hands together, please.